Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we open up the technical net, as we've done for the last 36 years. It runs from 8 o'clock until almost midnight. If there's enough enthusiasm to run that long, sometimes we stop a little bit earlier. The technical net gathers people who are curious about wireless equipment, curious about the 26, 27, maybe it's even 28 different kinds of ham radio, once we include all the digital modes that are now coming about. The technical net is broken up into roughly three sections. The first section, we take check-ins from people who do have a question or a comment. So they give us their call letters, their name, and we take them in order and handle their questions or comments. That's followed by Dr. Roy, AC2GS, with the mailbag and the science talk section. And tonight, you'll be hearing about some very loud radio astronomy objects, gamma ray bursts, and speculations as to what they really are and why they're so extremely strong, even though so far away. And he's got a number of other puzzles. And then our third section is by Paul, WS2N, who gives us a space report and tells us what National Aeronautics and Space Administration and all the other worldwide agencies building spacecraft, what they're doing. When you sign into the TechNet, you're going to give me your call letters, your name. Try to remember to give me your name, because I'm so darn forgetful. I like referring to people by their name, followed by the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. Let me drop this. You need not sign in to just say you're listening. After 36 years and thousands of hours of the TechNet, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. You can find recordings of the last 11 years of the TechNet by going to a website called amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateurradio.tangovictor. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play back past TechNet. There's a lot of good information there. There are a number of college professors who tell their students to listen to that material to get a little bit of a feeling about the real world of radio electronics is like, which is relatively different from the way it's taught in the schools and colleges. Another website that gives you supporting material for the TechNet is LimarkTechNet.com. LimarkTechNet.com. T-E-C-H-N-E-T. L-I-M-A-R-C is for Limark. And in both of these places, you'll find information about Yagis and dipoles and Brown and Woodward curves, where if you know, let me drop it. If you know the diameter of a wire-like antenna, a dipole or a monopole-like antenna, if you know the diameter of the wire and the length of the wire in wavelength, you can go to the Brown and Woodward curves and find out just about exactly what the impedance you're going to see, the resistive component and the reactive component. An extremely valuable set of information. Many megabytes of data is there. Mr. Brown Woodward, somewhere around 1945, spent probably a man-year choosing wires of various diameters and lengths and measuring the real impedance, because the equations that try to predict the impedance do a mediocre job. It's really a complicated function, what's really going on there. But that's a valuable information where your particular antenna you're building, you can make a prediction ahead of time as to what impedance you're going to see and how hard does your antenna tuner have to work to bring that non-resonant length antenna. There's nothing magic about forcing the antenna to be a resonant length, any length of antenna with the Brown and Woodward curves and a sufficiently wide range antenna tuner. Any piece of wire can be made to radiate 98% of all the RF energy you've got. And that, of course, at times, in the case of the so-called infinitesimal dipole, it's very hard to believe. But you actually run the experiment, you'll be kind of amazed at what you find. Let me drop. And along the way, you'll be hearing some of the strange characteristics of a piece of transmission line, open wire line, coaxial cable. There's about 10 or 15 different kinds of transmission line. Strip line, microstrip, so on. Thin line. I can't even think of it. Coplanar waveguide and so on. certain length of transmission line, when you have anything but the characteristic beam from the far end, give you some peculiar impedances at the input end, which is predictable by way of a particular equation or of the Smith chart. So, impedance inversion, for instance. If your transmission line is an odd number of quarter wavelengths, long at your operating frequency, if the impedance at the far end is lower than it should be, the impedance at the input end will be higher than it should be, and vice versa. If it's an even number of quarter wavelengths, the impedance is repeated. Whatever you put on the far end is what you see on the input end, plus any slight variations because of insertion loss. That's a peculiar characteristic that allows you to make filters out of transmission line at times. Okay, at this time we're going to take check-ins. Reverting at Joe, W-2-R-Y-Y. Anyone else who has a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name at this time, and try to wait for the three or four beeps so we don't time out the machine. K2-R-Y-W, I'll be listening for check-ins.
N-2-E-O-Z.
Okay, so far we got Joe and Rich. Anyone else?
AC2DAW, Curtis.
Okay, Curtis, DAW, Delta Alpha Whiskey. Is your prefix Kilo Charlie 2, Curtis? Go ahead.
Yes.
Okay. So we've got Joe, Rich, Curtis. The next person who wants to sign in because it does have a question or a comment for the net, please give me your call letters and name at this time.
WB2GXM, Rich, and yes.
Very fine, Rich number two. And when it comes to the questions you guys asked, don't worry about your question being too simple, too complicated, too dumb. There's no such thing as a dumb question. The philosophy of the people on the TechNet is that the so-called dumb question represents the biggest difference between what the guy knows and what he would like to know. If you think about it, it's the most deserving question to get an answer. One last call. Anyone to check in, give me your call letters and name right now. We've got more than enough to get started. So, Joe, what's the latest tonight? On last week, we went halfway down the road to explain inductor-to-capacitor ratio to make a resonator and what Q you get, loaded and unloaded and so on. I maybe didn't make it quite clear enough, but once you know the unloaded Q of your inductor and capacitor as a resonator and how much the Q is lowered because of the loading network you've attached to it, the ratio of Q loaded to Q unloaded allows you to predict exactly what insertion loss that bandpass filter is going to give you if that's what you're using it for. So B2RYY, K2RIW, go ahead, Joe.
Good evening, Dick. W2RY. How's my audio? Okay? Copyable?
More than copyable? You sound good. Please proceed.
Okay, the question is not on resonance, but just a comment on that. I do remember seeing some old, much older commercial two-way equipment, Motorola's in specifics, where they used a helical front end in many of their radios, and they actually had a slot. They took some of these front ends apart. They actually had a slot cut between the coils to act as a capacitance window to go from coil to coil to coil to minimize the loading of each particular section of the filter. How's that for technology?
Yeah, I think they're sometimes called aperture coupling networks. If you build two helical resonators side by side, each one is in its own cavity, so to speak, and as on the wall between the two, you cut the right size aperture in the right position, you can affect the coupling coefficient between those two helical resonators. And I think it's primarily an inductive coupling that takes place through that aperture. But the energy is coupled from one to the other. And so it's a rather sophisticated way of building a multi-element filter with a number of helical resonators. The nice thing about a helical resonator is that for its volume, It probably is one of the methods of construction that gives you about the highest Q you can get in that particular volume. So helical resonators, properly constructed, are very useful. And there are various ways of tweaking them by compressing the turns and so on, and by having a variable capacitor at the end. The one thing you've got to worry about with a helical resonator is it's got to be properly supported, because it's capable of waving around inside of its cavity when you put acceleration on the outside of that cavity. Over to you, Joe. To B2RYY, T2RIW.
Yeah, a lot of interest in those things, but that's not my question this week. This is probably something that we've visited at least once already. It's a technical term, and I see it used frequently in expression of receiving signal strength in terms of how strong something's coming in, and it seems to be used in place of dBm, and the term is dBuv/m. Want to revisit that one?
Yeah, when it comes to measuring the signal strength that you're getting into your backyard, so to speak, you could start off with a standard known antenna, dipole, ground plane, whatever, and you could measure the signal strength that you get out of that, and you can rate that in microvolts, volts, milliwatts, and decibels of those milliwatts. dBm is a decibel with reference to 1 milliwatt. So with a standard gain antenna, that's one way of measuring signal strength. If you go the next step further, where you're now not pinning it down to a particular antenna that you've used, if you now want to go closer to the Bureau of Standards, the actual signal strength arriving in your backyard really has some number of volts per meter or microvolts per meter of signal strength. And depending on the gain and the characteristic of your particular antenna, you end up with some amount of power coming out of your receiving antenna when it's exposed to a signal strength of that number of microvolts per meter. Let me drop. Now, you could use as a standard of measurement 1 microvolt per meter. You could decide to call 1 microvolt per meter the 0 dB on your scale, very similar to what you do with measuring audio power. The standard there is 1 milliwatt of audio power is usually called 0 dBm, dB with reference to m, 1 milliwatt. So 2 milliwatts would be plus 3 dBm. Half a milliwatt would be minus 3 dBm. And so, by the same token, when it comes to signal strength coming into your backyard in free space, you could use 1 microvolt per meter as the zero on the scale. The nice thing about decibels is that it's a compressed network. Let me drop. You could have tremendously different signal strength between the input of the receiver and the signal strength of the last stage after 5 stages of amplification inside your receiver. I mean, there may be 10 million to 1 difference in the signal strength at the beginning of the receiver versus the detector, the last stage of the receiver. And 10 million to 1 is a big number to write down. But if you convert, if you represent things in decibels, 10 million, I think, is 100 dB, yes. I think it's 100 dB. So, but decibels run positive and negative. A fraction of your reference level would be negative decibels. And a zero signal strength, because decibels are 10 times the log if you're representing them in power, 20 times the log if you're representing them in voltage, and the log of zero is minus infinity, so signals that are very, very weak compared to your reference run into negative decibels, and that's a little bit hard to understand at first. The one thing wrong with decibels is it's the one set of units where you can't easily measure an absolute zero signal strength, and rarely do you really have absolute zero strength. The signal can get weaker and weaker, and with the right kind of a narrowband receiving equipment, you can still get a signal out of it. That signal coming from the Voyager spacecraft, billions of miles away, is at a signal strength so darn weak that that you have to use very special techniques in order to suck that signal out of the noise and get the information out of it. Let me drop. So signal strength measured with reference to 1 microvolt per meter of signal strength of E field coming into your backyard, you could call that 0 dB MV. With reference to a microvolt. So dBmV, I think, is usually reference to 1 microvolt per meter with signal strength measured in the decibel scale. And once you know the basic effective capture area or gain of your particular receiving antenna, there's a way of converting known signal strength, which is sometimes can be calculated in microvolts per meter, and dBm per microvolts per meter, into how many milliwatts of signal is going to come out of your antenna when it's properly aimed and receiving that signal. So converting from one to the other, the mathematics does at times get a little bit spooky. Maybe this helps somewhat, Joe. W2LYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I hear you, Eric. Well, the point you've mentioned about 10 times already, which I want a little further clarification, is per meter. Those two words, per meter. I understand with dBuV, if it's a reference to a microvolt, it's so many decibels above a microvolt. But explain exactly the rest of what you're saying, per meter.
Okay, before I do that, let's pick up Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I just want to give you a little bit of a correction. Typically in my world, dBmV stands for dB per millivolt, and it's usually at 75 ohms. dBuV is
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You need much, much more signaling at the repeater, Eric.
And we heard your first sentence, Eric, and after that you moved the handy talkie to a position where it became unreadable. But you're right. UV is microvolts. MV is millivolts, or milliwatts. So dBuV per meter. Now, when it comes to a signal strength in free space, the units there are volts per meter. Could make believe you're using some kind of a measuring device which has a physical length of 1 meter, and you're able to, by some magic, calibrate this thing so that the number of microvolts picked up by this device that's 1 meter long would give you microvolts per meter. So signal strength in free space is a voltage across a distance. The distance might be your 80-meter dipole, which is really 40 meters long because it's a half wave. And so depending on how many microvolts of signal it picks up, you would divide that by the 40 meters of its length in order to get the signal strength in volts per, or microvolts per meter. So voltage in free space is voltage across a known distance. The implication is that if the signal is really coming from a long distance away, it's a really planar wave by the time it gets to your backyard, that if you decided to measure it at 1 meter of length, you'll get a certain amount of volts across the tips of that 1 meter. And if you decided to measure it with a 2 meter length measuring device, you would get twice the number of volts. The E field is a great big tic-tac-toe screen. Where if it's a vertically polarized signal, each square vertically represents a certain number.
Repeater, timeout.
Each square vertically represents a certain number of microvolts across that square. So that wave, when it comes into your backyard from a long distance, is a planar wave. And if there wasn't any ground bounce giving you complications, if it was really a free space situation, in theory, you could measure it close to the ground, so to speak, 10 feet above the ground or 100 feet above the ground. And if there was no ground reflection, is measure the same number of volts per meter. I wonder if that makes it a little bit more clear, Joe. W12YY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Signal just took a jump there. You said something that's a key thing. You said the length of measuring device is 1 meter long, okay? That's understandable. In some cases, you use that length to measure a high frequency. The wavelength is much shorter than 1 meter. It's measuring longer frequencies, lower frequencies, the wavelength is much larger, okay? So how do you guarantee you're accurately measuring a signal if that length of measure is not tuned, or how do you account for tuning signals in the high beam? This is ridiculous. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, you suddenly got a lot louder. We heard everything you said up till now, Joe, so don't worry. Although it did become a little bit noisy. You're absolutely right. You would think that when you're making a measurement in microvolts per meter, that you're using a 1 meter length to make the measurement, and that the upper tip and the lower tip of this 1 meter device, you've got some kind of a voltage sensing device, and you're measuring the number of volts different between the upper sensor and the lower sensor. You would think you do that. You never do that. When you're really making a signal strength measurement, most of the time you're going to take whatever you think is a good standard gain antenna traceable to the bureau. Quite often it is a standard gain feed horn. Quite often they've got a gain of something like 15.5 dB over isotropic, 15.5 dBi, your standard gain horn. Your horn itself, because you know the wavelength you're operating at, or you know the physical dimensions of the horn, there's ways you can calculate by formula. Area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. So once you know the gain and the frequency, or lambda, of your wavelength, you know the gain of your horn, you know its wavelength, you know its effective capture area by that formula. Area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. Let me drop. Once you know the effective capture area of your receiving device that's measuring this unknown signal coming into your backyard, and you know exactly how many milliwatts or microvolts of signal came out of that horn, you can measure it in power, you can measure it in voltage, whatever. Once you know its area, you can calculate how many volts per meter across that area is required to give that signal strength. So you calculate the microvolts per meter, but never really measure it that way. You start off with an antenna of known area or known gain and calculate. And so even though it's in units of microvolts per meter, let me show you something else that's kind of strange. Let me drop. If an isotropic signal at 10 gigahertz is transmitting, let me pick a number, a 10 watt signal from 1 mile away, free space, and I calculate how many microvolts per meter I get into my backyard. That's a 10 gigahertz signal radiating 10 watts a mile away. And because the 10 gigahertz signal has a wavelength of roughly 1 inch, 3 centimeters, therefore your one meter would be almost 100 wavelengths. By the same token, if I use the same 10 watts of power at 80 meters instead of 10 gigahertz, the same amount of power isotropically radiated into my backyard would give you the exact same number of volts per meter, microvolts per meter. In one case, the 1 meter would be much too short compared to the 80 meter signal, and the 1 meter would be much too long compared to the 10 gigahertz, 1 inch wavelength signal. Does it matter? You get the same number of microvolts per meter if you start off with the exact same signal strength, isotropically radiated, measured at the same distance. That's a fancy way of saying, let me drop. I mean, one example of an isotropic antenna is a standard white light bulb, and I put that in the middle of a spherical room. And assume it's a 100 watt light bulb, and I set the spherical room up so that it's got the right amount of area, so that the surface area of that room is 100 square meters. If the signal coming out of that light bulb really is isotropic and there's 100 watts of it, and the total area of the room is 100 square meters, each square meter is going to get 1 watt of power, 1 watt per square meter. And I could calculate that into microvolts per meter of a light signal. And whether I used a low-frequency light bulb or a high-frequency light bulb, you know, a blue light bulb or a red light bulb, if the power coming out is the same, the microvolts per meter is going to be the same, and the milliwatts per square meter is going to be the same. So it is power that gives you volts per meter, or microvolts per meter, independent of the wavelength. Ain't that strange? So H-R-Y-Y, K-Q-R-I-W, the TechNet.
Okay, but it seems like you have to know the gain of your antenna, if it has any, over an isotropic source. And it's still a little spooky to think about this because, you know, you just make you wonder exactly how much of this energy you're actually capturing that is actually available in the air. So your antenna gain, I guess, has something to do with it also, doesn't it?
It sure does. In the case of that standard gain horn, at 15.5 dB of gain, and Emerson Cumming and other companies, I can't even think of the name of the company that makes these things. Donald McGolan is one of them that recently made them on Long Island. In the case of a feed horn, you can assume it's 99.9% efficient, as long as you haven't, covered it with a carbon granule, so to speak, as long as it's got reasonably conductive materials. What percentage of the signal is absorbed by your antenna is strictly a function of how good your antenna does an impedance match to free space. You could say the flaring out of the horn. The beginning of your horn might be a waveguide, a coax adapter. The horn itself is a kind of a flare. And you could, if you want to, say that the flare of the horn gives you a better impedance match between the WR90 waveguide at 10 gigahertz that you've used for the waveguide, the coax adapter, and free space, 377 ohms. The horn is giving you a kind of an adaption. Well, if you did a careful measurement, no matter what you use for an antenna, you'll find out it's got a certain capture area when receiving and a small amount of reflecting area. Not every bit of the signal goes into the antenna. A little bit of it always gets reflected because the antenna is a disturbing device in free space. There are very few antennas. About the only thing I know of that you can put in free space is a piece of anechoic material, carefully constructed so that it absorbs all the energy and turns it into heat. But you can't easily measure the signal that it's absorbed, if you know what I mean. So when you measure the gain of the antenna, the efficiency of its gathering the signal from free space is already wrapped into that measure.
Repeater, timeout.
So that efficiency is already there when you get a gain number. And the best way to measure the gain of an antenna is to build an identical pair of them and aim them at each other in free space with a known distance between the two. And so you can easily calculate how much loss free space has at each particular wavelength and for each mile of distance, so to speak. And then these two identical antennas, if they give you a signal that's 10 dB stronger than the free space calculation, and there's two of those antennas, you'll assume each one of them has got 5 dB of gain over isotropic. That's the so-called FRIES method, F-R-I-I-S, dual antenna technique for getting a very precise measurement of gain of two antennas, as long as you can make them identical. And even if you think they're not quite identical, you use a third antenna and test them in combination, and it'll eventually figure out what's going on. Oh, you, Joe, K2LIW.
W-H-R-Y-Y. And if you do that, at a given distance, how do you account for, or how do you take into account the fact that the signal is arriving from multiple different places? Because, as you said, it reflects off of trees, off of water towers, off of buildings, off of telephone poles, and so forth. How do you take that into your effect of your calculations?
At most of the frequencies you and I care most about, Joe, an anechoic chamber is almost useless. A well-constructed anechoic chamber does a beautiful job from roughly 2 gigahertz and higher. The number of anechoic chambers that have good performance below 2 gigahertz is very few, and it takes huge pyramid-shaped absorbing devices on the wall, and the chamber has to be extremely large. So at VHF frequencies, the most accurate measurement you and I can make is the so-called reflective ground plane antenna range measurement. You start off with a known, flat, highly reflecting surface over which you're going to make the measurement. At first you would think you take the transmitting antenna and receiving antenna and raise them as far as you can get them on the top of buildings, get away from that reflecting surface. That's the dumb way to do it. Since the reflecting surface is so predictable, you can use it in your favor. You start off with the transmitting antenna very close to the surface. And your receiving antenna, you put it downrange above this reflecting surface, which might be a great big parking lot. And because the surface is so reflecting, and how reflective it is, you can make measurements to confirm that. Your receiving antenna is now looking at the transmitting antenna above the ground, above the parking lot, and it's looking at the mirror image of one of them below the parking lot. That's a very predictable situation. You have one known major echo of that parking lot. And now, as long as you've chosen the right altitude and the right distance for your receiving antenna, you can make some very accurate measurements. So you can use the reflection of that great big flat parking lot in your favor. Yes, you want to choose a good parking lot that doesn't have a water tower alongside of it and a building alongside of it. But in the middle of a great big parking lot, you can make some very accurate measurements. Let me drop. For about a year and a half, I was making measurements at the Romare Development Center near Utica, New York. And they've got these two mountains a mile and a half apart with fancy equipment on the top of each of the mountains to make measurements at microwave frequencies. But when you get down to the VHF frequencies, they literally use their flat parking lot, not the area between the two mountains, to make the measurements by the reflective ground plane antenna range measurement technique. The antenna book by the ARRL, go to the right chapter on antenna gain measurements. You'll find this beautiful article by Dr. Dick Turian, W2IMU, that explains the mathematics and diagrams about how to do that. So you can intentionally make one very strong echo and use it in your favor. Over to you, Joe, KQRIW. I've often done that.
I guess it's going to take a little while for me to absorb all this, actually, if you understand, because it's still like I'm trying to break it down in pieces. Like, you can understand one half of it on the left side of the slash mark, but understanding the other side of the slash mark per meter is still, I guess, I'm going to just have to think about this for a while. But back to you. I think it's a fascinating subject because it's like almost like black magic because you can't see the radio wave, but you know how to sort of measure it and grab a handful of it in the air.
Let me try to give a ridiculous example. Let's assume now that I had a piece of resistive material, scrimshaw they call it. I've got this piece of gauze, and I've soaked it in carbon granules of just the right density so that the gauze has a resistivity of 377 ohms per square. What that really means is now this great big sheet of gauze, when it's dried, if I put a metallic strip across the top of it and it's a metallic strip across the bottom of it, and the square of resistive material is exactly one square meter, and I put my ohm meter touching the upper metallic strip and the lower metallic strip, and I measure exactly 377 ohms, we will say that that material, that's a great big sheet of gauze, has a resistivity of 377 ohms per square. I could make the square one square meter, I'll measure 377 ohms. I could make it 3 meters high and 3 meters wide, and put a 3 meter long strip of metal across the top and across the bottom. I'll again measure 377 ohms. That's why it's called ohms per square. You would think it's got to be exactly one square meter. Now, as long as it's really one completely square, and you've got a metal strip across the top and the bottom, no matter what size it is, you'll measure exactly 377. That's the way resistivity works. Okay. I've now got this thing set up vertical to my ground in the backyard, and a known signal is being aimed at this thing. And as the signal gets absorbed, it's creating a voltage distribution across that resistive material. And I now take my microwave probe, I take a pair of microwave probes into a good microwave scope.
Repeater, timeout.
And I connect one microwave probe to the upper metallic strip, and another microwave probe to the lower metallic strip. And assuming now that the two strips are exactly 1 meter apart, a known amount of power is going to distribute the signal as it gets absorbed by that resistive gauze, is going to create an E field across the gauze. It's applying power to the gauze. The gauze is getting warm. It's absorbing the RF energy. In the process, the upper metallic strip and the lower metallic strip has a voltage difference on each half sine wave of the RF signal hitting it. And my two scope probes would allow me to measure that voltage. And if those two strips are exactly 1 meter apart, and I measure 1 microvolt, I could say that that signal strength hitting that gauze has a E field of 1 microvolt per meter. I've taken a couple of liberties here, but I think you see the principle of every real signal creates a certain voltage across a certain distance when it's propagating through free space, Joe. W2LYY, K2LIW.
Okay, good explanation, Pat. This stuff's making a little clearer, but I guess, you know, it takes a little more, maybe a little more hammering in to eventually completely understand the concept, because you have to think about a lot of things that you're talking about. So, good. It's an interesting subject to entertain anyway.
Yeah, all the conversions that are used by the electromagnetic interference people between their so-called antenna factor, their methods of taking a standard gain antenna and making measurements inside of an anechoic chamber of how much conductive and radiated the signals are coming out of your black box that's being evaluated. They get all kinds of conversions. So the conversions we hold between all of these and the various power units, and each field's got its own vocabulary as to how they do things. And so antenna person talking to an EMI person. Sometimes the vocabulary represents a little bit of a problem. All right, we're going to go to the next person, which was Rich, N2EO. N2EO, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. First off, how are we coming in?
You're sounding very good. Just the right amount of audio into that microphone tonight.
All right, Dick, I'm glad to hear it. I had a problem in the past, but came back. The problem with the system, at one time, it looked like the SWR was rising, which it can't do when I kicked in the amplifier, a Henry 2K, with a pair of 3500Z. What it turned out to be, I had the shield plate off from the tubes. Once I put them on, the problem went away. Now the problem came back. And all I did was put a longer length of cable between the Kenwood transmitter and the amplifier. And again, when I turn the amplifier on, everything looks normal, and then it looks like the SWR is rising on the output of the amplifier, and you hear the reverberations in the transformer getting louder and louder and louder, and I have to cut it off. So I don't know what's causing it. I bought some, let me get a reset. I bought some split cords from, not from Amazon, I forget the company, the well-known company. I put them on the source of the cable going to the amplifier, not the load, and which would be the amplifier. and I put them on the source from the amplifier going to the antenna tuner. Maybe they should have been on the load, not the source. I'm still having the problem. Cable was made out of RG-195 by the thickness of RG-58, except it has a heavy shield and a metal shield as well. But I don't know what could be causing the problem. Back to that M2EO.
Assuming the cable is well constructed and has connectors, even crimp connectors that are well installed indoors, the cable is good for 80 or 90 dB of shielding. The cable itself doesn't require ferrite devices on the outside of it. So the cable that goes between your exciter and your amplifier shouldn't be cable length sensitive and doesn't require any ferrite devices. The cable that goes between your amplifier and the antenna tuner, again, is well shielded, doesn't require anything. The fact that your standing wave ratio under power seems to rise lets me make a guess that something funny is going on with your balancing device. The balancing device at high power is capable of saturating, and as it warms up, it changes its characteristics of saturation. I think there is a possibility that something funny is going on between your antenna and your balancing device, and saturation within the balance from the very beginning when you hit it with high power is giving you a high standing wave ratio back to the antenna tuner and creating the antenna tuner grief that you've had in the past where destruction is taking place. I think for some reason, let me drop. Your particular antenna tuner and its balance, your particular antenna and its balance cannot tolerate the full power your amplifier is capable of delivering. All the clues that I'm hearing lead me to that conclusion, Rich. I know that your exciter is only good for 100 watts, and you'd love to be able to use your amplifier at the kilowatt level. I think for the time being, you ought to throttle things back to, let me pick a number, the 200 watt level, and don't go beyond that. Because something is saturating, and when you see the amplifier, the standing wave ratio slowly increasing, and the fact that you're hearing humming out of your transformer implies that the current to the final stage is changing, the tuning of the final stage is changing, it's probably knocking itself out of resonance. Funny things are happening at the high power. For the time being, there's lots of evidence with all of the damage you've had in the last 6 months that your system is not capable of putting a kilowatt into that antenna, not even close. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
AC2GS.
Hey, go ahead, Roy.
Thanks, Dick. Just for historical purposes, the Balan, the original Balan was made by PALSTAR or was designed by PALSTAR. They discontinued that model. When Rich bought a replacement, it was the same original design. PALSTAR doesn't sell that design, doesn't manufacture that design anymore because they felt it was faulty. And he simply used an old stock PALSTAR Balan as a replacement that had the same faulty design in it. I'm just reminding people this is historical.
So, well, PALSTAR is recommending you don't use that exact design. It does suggest that other people have run into a very similar problem that Rich is running into right now. I'm led to believe that that PALSTAR Balan cannot tolerate anything like a kilowatt. Maybe it can tolerate 200 watts, but it's not going to take the kilowatt. All the destruction you've had strongly suggests that a lot of reflected power was coming back to your antenna tuner and to your amplifier and burning up the hardware and the standing wave measurement structure on the output of that antenna tuner. So that PALSTAR cannot, no matter what the manufacturer said in the original spec when you bought it, it can't take the high power. To be on the safe side, you ought to use the barefoot 100-watt exciter. But if you insist on using the amplifier, I would throttle it back to never go beyond 200 watts from everything I'm hearing, Rich. N2EO, K2LIW. Otherwise, you're going to create more destruction.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. Over from a brand new balance, a new design from Palestine. And the problem only came up when I hooked up the new cable between the amplifier and the exciter. Before that, everything was fine. I don't get it.
AC2GS.
2FIU.
A cable between amplifier and exciter that could be a red herring. The fact that it got changed and the fact that it's longer doesn't really mean that it's the cause of what you're now seeing. So we're going to go to Roy and George in that order. AC2GS, K2IW, go ahead, Roy.
Okay, again, my understanding based upon talking about this and listening is that the first balun was replaced with a second balun. They are the exact same design. Andy opened it up and looked inside, same exact design. So unless Richie bought a third balun that I'm not aware of, he's using the same old balun design. It's a new balun, but it's an old design.
George, go right ahead.
KD2FIU. Let's, for one look at this, take any impedance or balancing matching devices out of the equation here. Let's look at the antenna as a device at its feed point. I understand it is a folded dipole random length wire antenna. Is that correct, Richie?
I wouldn't call it random length. That's a known good design. Rich, tell them the model number of your particular multiband antenna.
Yes, Dick, you know the design more than I do. It's a Cobra compact antenna. That's the name of the company.
So it's a known performance antenna, George. And so... And it's recommended to have a particular impedance ratio balance. But let's double check what Roy just asked about, Rich. You went and bought a brand new balun, but when Andy looked inside, it was the exact same old design. Would we be correct to say you did not buy or get a third balun? Is that true, Rich? N2EO, K2LIW?
No, I did not get a third balun. According to Palstar, they added a capacitor.
Yeah, but that particular design of Palstar, I'm led to believe, with the fact that they discontinued it for use in your particular circumstance, I'm convinced that no matter what it used to say for its specifications, it cannot tolerate a kilowatt. And the nasty thing that a balun can do under certain conditions is that when that ferrite saturates, all kinds of crazy performance will take place, and you'll get an extremely high standing wave ratio from the balun. Even the antenna itself might not be at fault. So let's see what George has to say about this. Mr. FIU, K2IW.
Okay, we've got to look at the feed line. I've been told that the two different things about the feed line, that it is an open wire line. Richie, you've also told me that it is a 450 ohm window wire line, which is different from an open wire feed line. Okay, so we're coming in with two different impedances. My first question is, with no equipment of that feed line arriving at your station with no balance, no impedance matching devices and everything, where does that antenna device system resonate? Has anybody ever tested that? Is it 10.5 megahertz? Is it 5.6 megahertz? Is it 15.4 megahertz? As a good working product, where does it resonate? And when you have these problems, as that feed and antenna device system arrives inside your station, is it ever changing when you are looking at your problems?
The 450-ohm lateral line is part of the supplied hardware with that Cobra compact antenna. That's the way it arrives. I think it arrives with everything except the balance. And he added the power star at the front to it. So there's only one impedance of ladder line going from his shack to that antenna, supplied by Cobra. So the antenna is being fed.
Repeater, timeout.
The antenna is being fed exactly the way Cobra intended it to be fed, with one exception. The ladder line was longer than he needed, and some of it got chopped away. So the transmission line did get shortened, which might be an aggravating factor. There, we're not sure. But there's only one impedance of line between that balance and that Cobra antenna. Is that a little bit more clear, George? Over to you, George, KQIW.
Thank you, Dick. KD2FIU. My point is, what was the testing? What values did it represent? What frequency did it dip at? What was the capacitive return? What was the inductive? Where was it resonant? And when you have your troubles, just look at, just for isolation purposes, let's eliminate that by saying, what was it supposed to do versus what it is doing every time you see your trouble? We don't know. We don't know. We're relying on what was there. That's a factor to say, isolate this. Then bring the station in.
Yeah, stand by a second, Roy. Rich, of all the visits you've had from Andy and 2MB, Barry, did either of those guys use any instrumentation to add a low power level, like with a antenna analyzer? Did they measure the VISWR of your antenna? Was the VISWR of your antenna in the shack ever measured by any of the people that have ever visited you, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW?
N2EO, why? I fell. Down the tuner is a feed loop position, and every band it was 4-to-1 without the tuner.
Okay, 4-to-1 is a little bit high, but not a showstopper. AC2GS, K2RIW, you got it, Roy.
Not answering this. Okay, one moment, George. I'm just informationally, no one swept the antenna, to my knowledge, with an antenna analyzer. That's low power, certainly not high power. I think what usually was done is the driver was driven and people looked at the SWR meter. That's the only thing that was done. No one, to my knowledge, swept it with an antenna analyzer. So although, George, your comments are valuable, they don't really, there's no information available for any of that, unfortunately.
And the PALSTAR balance with a 1-to-1 match probably is good to some particular power level. If the antenna truly has a 4-to-1 standing wave ratio and power is feeding it, most likely the maximum power that the PALSTAR can tolerate is now considerably lower. So for a whole bunch of reasons, I think for the time being, I would not go above, let me pick a number, 200 watts into that antenna. It's not going to make you the biggest noise on the band, but if your attempt to be the biggest noise in the band and radiate a kilowatt because your amplifier is capable of doing that, and it keeps burning up your antenna tuner, that's not a good way to go. The new cable that was installed, I think, is a red herring, Rich. You can easily measure the quality of that cable by using your ohm meter. I mean, is the shield well connected from the two ends, the center conductor well connected between the two ends, and the shield and center conductor not shorted each other, and visually you inspect the connectors on the ends. That cable is a well-shielded structure, and the fact that this grief happened just because that cable was changed doesn't mean the cable caused the problem. That could be a red herring. N2EO, K2LIW. The next time somebody visits you, let's hope that they bring the right instrumentation where they can re-measure the VISWR on each of your favorite bands with whatever they bring to measure VISWR. Over to you, Rich.
Okay, well, the only one I know is Andy. I think he has an analyzer, correct?
Yeah, can I interject, please?
Yeah, he's got lots of test equipment. Go ahead, George.
Thank you, KD2FIU. The point I'm trying to make is the antenna system as an antenna device with the line where it enters the station with nothing on it. If it's working properly, it will have some kind of resonant point with a reasonable resistance and a reasonable a capacitive hold and an inductive hold. Was that ever measured so that we could say that when we're looking at this problem, when it crops up, let's look at the device leaving the line and the antenna itself. Not whether it's resonating on particular bands. Where does it resonate, period? Was it 15.1, 4.7? Was it 10.2? Do you follow what I'm saying? So that when these problems crop up, we could look out and say, is it what's outside or is it what's inside?
Oh, I understand. Dick, if the band is after the tumor, why would it show up on the meter on the tumor before the bowing?
George is saying that the exact frequency of resonance is something very important. I think of greater importance is what standing wave ratio do you measure in each of the bands where you intend to use the antenna? And compared to what the manufacturer claims the standing wave ratio on those bands should be, you can make a judgment that the antenna is behaving correctly or incorrectly. My antenna may have an exact resonance of 10.3 megahertz, but if at 14.1 it gives me a 1.8 standing wave ratio, that's good enough, in my opinion. So the real VISWR you get on each of the bands where you're going to use it is the most important factor in my mind. And if anything funny is going on with the antenna and the balance, it will be reflecting signal back to the antenna tuner. And if that reflected signal to the antenna tuner is beyond a certain number of watts, the antenna tuner output circuit that measures the VISWR, that piece of printed circuit board with its diodes, detectors, and whatever, that becomes overheated and damaged. That's what Andy saw in the past. That got burned up. So a lot of power and a lot of reflective power from the balance, so to speak, was coming back to the output circuit of the antenna tuner, creating all that damage. Burning up the air variable capacitor and burning up that printed circuit board. Right now, everything I'm hearing tells me that you might be getting saturation of that PAL star. And maybe the PAL star in your environment cannot tolerate more than, let me pick a number, 200 watts. In which case, you better throttle back and to be on the safe side, use the barefoot exciter into that system. Over to you, Rich, N2EO, KGRIW.
Repeater, timeout.
Okay. Would you suggest I order a ballon from a different company? I forget the name of the company that made those cords. Not Amazon, it's another company, but they have a ballon. And I know somebody who uses that company's ballon for one. An alpha. To give him my amp to a G5RV.
Andy, this is here. Can I tell you, please?
Go ahead, Roy.
Thank you, Dick. Cobra Ultralight, the company that makes his antenna, recommends people use the Balan Designs Balan, and even has a